This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and it's presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in the saddle with you for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website. You're listening there at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest is a 25-year-old native of Kingston, Jamaica, who began his training career in the United States in 2018. He has 9 winners to his credit and has been tantalizingly close to a career-changing breakthrough win in a graded stakes on several different occasions. And thanks to his talented 4-year-old filly Dream Marie, you have to feel like that win is coming and coming before too long. Dream Marie has finished second or third in 3 separate graded stakes and most recently finished fourth in the prestigious Grade 2 Delaware Handicap on July 10th. Please join me in welcoming trainer Matt Williams to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, appreciate the time.
Yeah, no problem, Mike. Happy to be here.
You know, I talk about Dream Marie. I mentioned her, and I think that we need to start with her because she has been so good to you. And I mentioned that you're so close to that breakthrough win. She has faced some top competition, and you have to feel like that big win is just around the corner, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've been hoping she would have been a stakes winner from a long time ago. She was graded stake place, the first stakes race she ran in the Davonadale at Gulfstream, running third there. And I thought she ran a pretty good race, and then she just been consistent, especially going a mile and over on the dirt in those various stakes races.
When did you kind of get a sense that you might be sitting on something special with Dream Marie?
After she won the second race that she won, the start of 50, I think that was in December of her 2-year-old year at Gulfstream. She came from really far back, and you didn't see her till like the 2.5 at the 2.5 pole, when the others were like almost in the stretch, and she really came blowing past them, you know. And that's when I really thought she could be really something special.
People will look at her record now. She's a 4-year-old filly. People will say, okay, but she only has 5 wins from 20 starts. But Matt, she hardly ever runs a bad race. She always shows up.
Yeah, I think so. You know, when things go in a good way for her, she definitely tries hard. She's you know, she's a really nice horse. She's an honest, trying horse. You know, sometimes things just didn't work out for her in certain races. That's why she probably threw in a bad race. But overall, she's been consistent and sound, you know.
She was a $25,000 sale purchase back in 2019. Are you the one that picked her out?
Yes, yeah, I purchased her. My dad and I, we were at the OBS March sale that year, and she was the last horse through the ring that the first day of the sale, and yeah, we purchased her.
What did you like about her that made you pull the trigger?
Well, first, you know, her catalog page, that's where it always starts with for me, buying a horse. She was by Gradar, who was a Grade 1 winner. I saw him win the Dan Handicap at Gulfstream. He was by Unbridled Song, who I think is a good sire line. Her mom, Dreamery's mom, was by Curling, who was obviously a horse of the year and at one time the leading money earner. And, you know, the page just looked good to me. Then when we actually saw her physically, she was really big, but she looked pretty balanced. Everything I liked about her. And, you know, we looked at the vet report. She was clean, and she was, I think, the second horse that we bid on that day. The other was another Gradar.
Yeah, Gradar was pretty tough.
She was the one that we got.
Do you put more emphasis on pedigree or on the actual physical of the horse when you're going through and picking horses out at the sale?
Personally, I start with the pedigree. You know, something has to be on a page that I like. You know, it's really subjective. I can't tell you specifically what I would like about it. I just look at the page and, you know, things that I like about it, then I'll probably mark down the horse and then look at the horse physically and also have to like the horse, you know.
Yeah, well, you liked her a lot, and you can see why, because she has earned now over, what, $300,000 in her career?
Yes, yeah, 317, I think.
Yeah, you got it right down to the penny, right?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. You mentioned your dad was there with you at the sale. Your dad's involved in horse racing too, or just a fan?
He and my mom and myself, we own the horses. He also owns horses in Jamaica, but his involvement in horse racing was really because of me, I believe.
How so?
My mom's side of family, they were very heavily involved with horse racing, and I really took a liking to it. And because I wasn't, you know, getting really involved, he ended up owning horses, and we ended up owning horses over here as well, and we are where we are now, you know, type of thing.
Tell me more about your mom's side of the family.
Yeah, my mom's dad, he bought his first horse in like 1964. I think he wanted to be a jockey when he was growing up, but he was too big for that. His brother ended up being a jockey, and his brother, I think he's the only person to have won a race at three different racetracks in Jamaica. Now there's only been one racetrack since like 1959. So, and then his brother also ended up becoming a trainer. But my grandfather, he bought his first horse, then he ended up buying a horse farm till he became a big commercial breeder in Jamaica. And he became the champion breeder for 10 years in Jamaica, 97 to 2004, and then 2008.
Wow. Yeah, he had a ton of success. Who didn't he breed a Triple Crown winner too?
Yeah. He bred a Triple Crown winner. She was a filly. She won the Jamaican Triple Crown 2008. Her name was Al Sapra. She was a granddaughter. Her dad's sire was deputy minister. We had a stallion. He actually died last year down there in Jamaica. And her mom was a granddaughter of Secretariat.
Oh, wow. So that would have made you, let's think, 2008, you would have been, what, about 12 years old at that time?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah, 12 years old, yeah, going 13, something like that.
Did you go, like, along with your grandfather when she was going through that Triple Crown, or were you still a little bit too young?
Yeah, I was there. I think I have a couple of pictures at home in Jamaica, me collecting the trophies for the breeder. When I was there when she won the three Triple Crown races plus the Jamaica Oaks.
Wow, so, that is so cool. What is the Jamaican Triple Crown?
So it's kind of like England. We have the 1,000 and 2,000 guineas, 1,000 for fillies, 2,000 for colts, and then you could have two horses going for the Triple Crown, either a filly or a colt after that. Then they normally go to the Derby and then the St. Ledger. But this year they kind of changed last year, they, because of COVID, they changed around the schedule of it.
How many Jamaican or winners of the Jamaican Triple Crown have there been?
I believe, I could be a little off. I think between 13 and 14, something like that.
Wow, that's so cool. That's really neat. I had no idea how that worked.
2017, and that was a filly as well.
So it's not uncommon to see the fillies win the Triple Crown.
No, just because the horse population isn't so big in Jamaica, so it's common to be running fillies against colts.
So obviously your grandfather had a major influence on you wanting to be involved in horse racing. Did you ever do anything outside of racing when you were growing up, or was it, were you always around the horses?
Yeah, pretty much always around the horses. My dad, he had a trucking business. I was there as well too. But you know, horses, I guess, was always my first passion or whatever you'd say.
Did you always know that somehow, some way, you were going to be involved?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think when I was really young, I wanted to be a jockey. But, you know, I kind of outgrew that dream or whatever. And definitely, I always knew I was going to become a trainer. I also was planning on becoming a vet, but still planning to become a trainer. But I ended up, after about my second year in college, I just forgot about being a vet and just became a trainer.
Wow. So what year was that?
When I was in college, maybe about 2016, somewhere about there.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I've become good friends with jockey Rajiv Miraj, who is also from Jamaica, and quite often when he wins a big race, I'll send him a picture with me drinking a red stripe in his honor. And toasting him with red stripe. So I'm just kind of curious, how do you celebrate when you get a big win, Matt?
Celebrate? Maybe I'll drink a red stripe too. pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Talking with trainer Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you're just joining us, Matt grew up in Kingston, Jamaica. His grandfather, a 10-time champion breeder there, that's how he got interested in the sport, and it has just grown from there. And he has a pretty good filly now by the name of Dream Marie, who is still searching for that first Great Stakes win. But, boy, she has been so close on so many occasions, and she's a really nice filly. She was fourth in the Delaware Handicap about 10 days ago. It was July 10th when she ran in that race. Matt, listen, when you first started being around your grandfather's operation, tell me about his operation and what things he taught you that you still use today.
Well, he was very meticulous in the care of his horses and the setup and layout of his farm. You know, he really didn't leave any stone unturned. I remember as a kid, me and my cousin, we'd walk around the farm picking up stones just to ensure the horses don't step on it, you know. So yeah, he was really meticulous in that way.
How big was his farm?
It was 111 acres. He had about 40 mares, and we always had like 2 to 3 stallions. We had a son of AP Indy, a son of Unbridled, son of Vice Regent, son of Deputy Minister, and a son of Seattle Slow in the early days.
How did you end up learning so much about the pedigree side? Because when you talk about these horses, the first thing you go to is pedigree. How did you learn all about pedigree?
That's because I guess we were in breeding. I was always just drawn to it and trying to learn as much as I could about the sire lines, female families, things like that. And I think, it, in my opinion, it plays a big part in the racehorse that you do have, you know. And I think it's a building block for their success somewhat, in my opinion. And you know, I just kind of read all the trade papers, Blood Horse, growing up, and all the, you know, pouring over the stallion register. I remember my grandfather, he used to get the stallion register every year from the Blood Horse stallion register, and I'd look through it, you know.
It's incredible. I remember when I first moved to Kentucky back in the late 90s, and I was just a horse racing fan. I could bet races and I could handicap, but when it came to the language of the industry, it took me a long time to learn it. And my first job was at the Jockey Club, working with the sales catalogs and putting those together. And that's where I got to learn about pedigrees and the language of the sport. And I'll give you an example. I can remember that I used to say, oh, this horse is, you know, out of AP Indy. instead of by APND. And you don't think, you know, that that's a big deal, but obviously it's not the correct way to say it. So I had to learn those things before I could move forward. And it sounds like you had a great base there to build from.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that was always kind of the emphasis for me, the breeding aspect of the whole thing.
Do you have a favorite stallion?
I'd say probably Tuppet now.
I thought for sure you were going to say Gradar.
Well, I do like Gradar. And all the Unbridled Songs, you know.
Unbridled Song. I mean, I can remember, you know, watching him run and of course, the beaten favorite in the Kentucky Derby. But I can remember how, you know, courageous that race was, even though he got beat. Wasn't he running with a bar shoe that he had on that day?
Yeah, I think he had a quarter crock or something.
Yeah. Would you get the races in Jamaica and watch them on TV? The American races?
Yes, we would. You know, I'd watch like TVG growing up. And I think I'm pretty sure I watched the Derbies of Funnyside and Smarty Jones. But the one I really remembered the best was Barbaro in 06. Actually remembering that one.
Were you training in Jamaica before you came to the United States?
No, I wasn't. I was just with my... I was telling my grandfather, his brother, he was a jockey. Then he became a trainer. And he won some classic races in Jamaica, trained a champion too. So I was there with him and his son, who is also a trainer. And then that's where I was really kind of, you know, getting to really be in the training aspect of it. And then I came over here. I bought my first horse. And you mentioned Rajiv Maharaj, his uncle, Alan Maharaj. He was the one that kind of got me the foot in at Calder. He trained the first horse for me before I started training him myself, and he just kind of showed me the ropes over here.
Yeah, that family, the Mirage family, well, first of all, I had Rajiv on the show with me, and I asked him to walk through his entire family for me, and it took him about a half hour to go through all of them, but he got through all the Mirages.
Really, and horse racing involves family.
They love horse racing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all love horse racing. What things did you said Alan helped you along? How did he do that?
Yeah, you know, just getting into Calder, getting me into Calder, and you know, at the time it's Gulfstream Park West, and just kind of showing me the ropes of how things, you know, go here. Things are a little different, you know, in the mornings training here than in Jamaica, and he just kind of helped me along that way.
What's morning training like in Jamaica? What makes it different?
Well, slightly different. You know, in Jamaica, we don't really have a hot walker. The groom maybe looks after two or three horses. They'd, the grooms would bring the horses up to the track. The riders would actually get on at the track. Here, the riders would get on at the barn, you know. And you don't really have one rider working for maybe one person. It does happen, but, you know, you have more like freelance type of riders in Jamaica. And it's mostly jockeys that do, you know, everyday gallop for the horses and things like that.
And that's all at Caymanas Park now, right?
Yes, Caymanas Park. Yeah, that's the racetrack there.
Yep, and a big, big racing surface. I've told people before that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, because you would know better than I would, but isn't the racing surface there similar to like a Belmont Park in terms of the size of it?
It's a mile and an eighth, 9 furlongs around.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But I always thought it was closer to a mile and a half.
Two very long shoots. You can have 5 furlong straight races and 9 furlongs around one turn from the chute.
How often do they race in Jamaica?
I believe it's around 80 days for the year. It used to be like every Saturday. Used to be most Wednesdays. Now they're kind of gone to Sundays and every public holiday except for Good Friday and Christmas.
Are they well attended?
Yeah, I'd say so. There's a lot of very passionate horse people in Jamaica.
for some, like here, we have so many different ways to bet the races. You can bet them on the different ADWs. You can, in some states, go to an OTB and bet off track, or a simulcast center, whatever it might be. Do they have those types of things in Jamaica, too, where you can go and bet the races without actually going to the track?
Yeah, their OTBs pretty much all over the country. And they've also had new, like, online platforms through your phone as well. I'm not sure if it works exactly like an ADW, but I think it's pretty similar.
You know, it was great that you had somebody like Alan Mirage to be able to help you when you got here. But I can imagine for a young kid like that, Matt, and what were you? You were in your early 20s, if not right around 20, when you came to the United States. There had to be some anxiousness on your part, you know, coming to a new country, starting your own business. Tell me about that. Tell me about what you went through as you were getting started.
Well, I actually went to high school in Florida here, and then I went to college as well. And between that time, I was in Jamaica. I went back to Jamaica. Starting was, I guess I always knew this is what I wanted to do. So it really didn't matter too much to me. You know, I just kind of knew that, you know, we'd have to get it done some way, somehow type of thing.
So you weren't nervous coming back here, starting your own business? That didn't even faze you, probably, huh?
No. I knew, you know, my parents, they really support, you know, our operation, and especially my dad. He's really optimistic about the whole thing and all the horses. So, you know, I guess we're optimistic about everything, and, you know, we just kind of try to make it work as we go along.
How many horses does your dad own now?
We have 8, and then in Jamaica, we have 4 runners.
Okay. And is it just you and your dad, or do you have some other outside clients that you train for, too?
No, yeah, it's pretty much just my parents and me for these horses.
Wow, what a ride, too. When you teamed with your dad on Dream Marie, and you found out that she could be this caliber and be a graded stakes type of filly, boy, that had to be a great conversation to have with your father, huh?
Yeah, I think, you know, we went to the Kentucky Oaks, and I don't think anyone was as excited as he was, you know. I think he was happiest about the whole thing. And, you know, being multiple graded plays, you know, he was probably the happiest about all of it.
Tell me more about that experience. I mean, the Kentucky Oaks, you're talking about the premier race, or certainly one of the premier races for 3-year-old fillies in the United States and maybe even in the world. Tell me about what that was like for you.
Yeah, you know, definitely. We were, after the Davona Dale, she ran third. We thought, you know, maybe we could make it. Then she didn't do so well in the Gulfstream Park Oaks. She ran sixth. That was Swiss Sky Dava's coming out party. But then, you know, with the delay, they pushed it back to September. I knew maybe we would have had a shot. And my plan was the Delaware Oaks and the Monmouth Oaks. She picked up points in both races, and, you know, that's how we ended up going. You know, I definitely understand the significance of the race, you know, because, you know, it's such a great race. I remember, like, Rachel Alexandra drawing off to win by, like, 20 in 2009. So, you know, I was happy to be there, you know. And, you know, it didn't really go the way we probably hoped it would have. But I guess, you know, it was a real good experience for all of us, the chance to go there and be at Churchill, you know.
What was it like for you to be around some of the top trainers that we've seen in the history of the sport? People like Todd Pletcher, for example, and Brad Cox. And, I mean, what was it like to be around those individuals that week?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of awe-inspiring, you know, to have a horse in a race with these guys at this level, you know, Hall of Fame trainers, future Hall of Fame trainers, you know. It definitely made me feel inspired, but, you know, at the same time, we hope to have beaten their horses.
Yeah, I guess when you come walking through that tunnel at Churchill, right, you walk over from the barn area, you come through the tunnel, and you enter into the paddock area out back.
Yeah.
For you, that had to be one of those dream moments, no pun intended with Dream Marie, but one of those dream moments that you just, you know, growing up as a horse racing fan, you have to almost pinch yourself, right, Matt?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I didn't really give myself too much time to think. I was just hoping, you know, I settled her right and everything went well with her, you know. I didn't think too much about it.
Put the saddle on the right side. Yeah, put the saddle on the right side and make sure that you don't throw the jockey over when the jock gets a leg up.
Yes, yep, right.
And that was it Joe Talamo that was aboard that day?
Yes, it was Joe Talamo.
Yeah. Yeah, another one of my favorite jockeys. Joe was, top apprentice and leading rider down there at the fairgrounds when he was first getting started. And I remember when we were just getting started with HRN, we were there at the Louisiana Derby to broadcast the race on national radio for the first time. And we were doing a morning show, the morning of the race, and Joe came out and sat down for an interview. And it was one of his very first national interviews that he had done, and we had so much fun, and he's never forgotten it. I've never forgotten it, and I just think he's a classy individual.
Yeah, definitely. You know, he's been like a really cool guy. You know, I watched him on Jockeys on Animal Planet back in the day as well, and he was doing really well. So yeah, I think actually we tried to probably have gotten him on her in the Delaware Oaks, but he had ridden another horse. And that's how Joe Bravo ended up riding her in that last year. And then because he was in Kentucky, it just kind of happened, you know, that he ended up riding her for the Kentucky Oaks.
What about Rajiv? You didn't want to give a leg up to the home team?
Yeah, well, Rajiv, he rode her twice. He rode her in the Hollywood Wildcat here at Gulfstream about 7 weeks after the Gulfstream Park Oaks. She ran second, Tonally Shape won the race. And he had ridden her again after that, the Game Face Stakes. She finished last in that. You know, it was 6.5 sprinting. But I really think what really affected her was the she kind of acted up a bit in the gates, and she kind of hit the front, fell back on her hocks, and you know that was just the end of her day for that race.
Yeah. You know, we talk about Rajiv, and of course Sean Bridgemahan, a native of Jamaica and another top rider in the sport. Those are two guys that I think often get overlooked when we talk about some of the top jockeys in the sport. There have been some really good riders that come from Jamaica, and as somebody, Matt, who thought about being a jockey at one point, why do you think that is? Why do you think that Jamaica's been able to produce so many good riders?
Well, you know, I think Jamaica, there's a lot of involvement in the horse industry, and you see there's a lot of Jamaican trainers here as well. So you know, I think maybe just because there's that kind of emphasis on it there in Jamaica, you know, some guys come over here and they do really well. You know, you see it a lot too in, like, you know, Ireland and Venezuela. There's like a lot of horse people from those countries here as well. You know, just because I think they've got such, like, well-developed horse racing industries, you know, there, and, you know, a lot of involvement there, you know.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Talking with trainer Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, believe it or not, 30 minutes down, another 30 to go. We'll do it when we return. Stay with me. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This summer, Fasig Tipton celebrates the 100th renewal of the Saratoga Sale, the world's most prestigious auction of selected yearlings in a single catalog. A sale that has produced 100 years of Breed Shapers, Eclipse Champions, Classic Winners, and International Stars. Join us for the Sale of a Century, the 100th Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, August 9th and 10th in Saratoga Springs, New York. Where will you be?
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And Dream Marie is coming with a 3-wide kick, and Market Rumor starts to gain momentum too. These are the four inside the quarter pole. Bajan Girl scrapes paint. Miss Marissa takes the lead, but Dream Marie continues this mid-track charge. Off the turn, and they race for home, and here comes Market Rumor down the wide outside. Three Principals with an eighth of a mile to go. Miss Marissa getting everything thrown at her, with Bajan Girl trying to press on pass, and now Dream Marie hits the front, and Dream Marie is pulling away to win the Obeya Stakes over Miss Marissa, Market Rumor, and Bajan Girl.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday afternoon, visiting with trainer Matt Williams, the native of Jamaica. And that call of Dream Marie winning the Obeya back on June 9th at Delaware Park is a special moment for him and for his family. Want to remind you before I continue this visit that if you missed any portion of the show or any of our trainer talk shows, simply head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our trainer talk shows at your leisure. They are there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, another way to get those shows. And by the way, anywhere you get your podcasts, you can tune in to the Horse Racing Radio Network and all of our shows. Well, Matt Williams is indeed with me, and Matt, that call has to take you on a little trip down memory lane, huh?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it was really nice, or you know, wonderful to kind of hear that call again, watching the race. You know, I've probably watched it like 50 times, but yeah.
Have you really? You've gone back and watched it that much?
More or less.
That's great, because oftentimes I will ask trainers that question. I will say, listen, how many times have you watched that replay? Sometimes trainers will tell me, I just don't do that. You know, maybe someday I'll go back and watch it, but I haven't watched it. But I love the honesty. Yeah. Hey, that was a big win. I've gone back and watched it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Was that your first stakes win?
Yes, it was.
Wow, what a special moment. Was your dad there with you?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't there.
No, that's too bad. It would have been great to celebrate with him.
Yeah. I think maybe you'd have gone a bit too overboard, but
a few too many red stripes after that race.
Yes, probably.
Hey, that's okay. So you beat Miss Marissa in the Obeya. She comes back in the Delaware Handicap, turns the tables on you and everybody else, and takes the field wire to wire. We mentioned Dream Marie was fourth in that race, but you still had to be proud with the effort that she gave you.
Yeah, definitely. I thought she ran, you know, a very fair race. I think it was pretty much just a slow pace, and, you know, Miss Marissa having it her own way. You know, she's a very good filly, and when she gets it her own way, she's tough to beat.
When you're watching a race, you're there at the track and watching one of your horses. Are you the type of trainer that likes to get excited when they're coming down the stretch, or are you more laid back?
I'd say I'm more laid back.
Yeah, you don't get fired up, especially when she was winning the Obeya, your first stakes win. Did you get fired up, or were you chill?
Maybe I was slightly a bit fired up at that point watching her come, but. Yeah, I think generally I'm mostly laid back, you know.
Do you have any superstitions? Are you superstitious at all, Matt?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah, well, that's good, because that can get you in trouble. You can yeah. You can waste a lot of time worrying about superstitions, and trust me, I am as superstitious as it comes when I'm betting horse races. If I'm on a hot streak, I have to use the same pen. The tickets have to go into the same pocket. I have to go to the same teller if I'm betting with a teller. Yeah, I'm a wacko with stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's been working, you don't want to change, right?
No, it's a great point. How do you describe, Matt, your overall training philosophy?
That's a good question. You know, I like to think I take it a bit easier on them. You know, I like to think that I don't rush them too much, especially when they're 2-year-olds. And I don't think I think the earliest I've probably started a two-year-old was maybe September. Although, you know, it's been a small sample size. But
is there a bit of a fine line that you have to follow there, Matt? Because you don't want to go too hard on them, but if you go too easy on them, that doesn't work either. How do you find the happy medium?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I just, you know, try and have some kind of feel for the horse, you know, like in their everyday gallops, I like them to be nice and comfortable. And then, you know, every 7 days we probably give them a breeze. And, you know, we try to build up for every subsequent breeze, you know, and then hopefully for a race.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it different training horses here in the United States than the approach? And I know you didn't train in Jamaica before you came here, but you watched a lot of trainers and you watched your grandfather and how he handled his operation. Is it different in the United States than it is in Jamaica getting a horse ready?
No, it's pretty much very similar, you know, training on the truck. Pretty much very similar, you know. I kind of brought my – it's the same approach that I had in Jamaica is what I have here. The only thing in Jamaica, there's also a pool on the truck, so you could swim there. And the sea isn't too far. Horses do swim in the sea.
Yeah. You know, several trainers that have come on this show over the years, established trainers that have won thousands of races, they always seem to tell me that you never stop learning. No matter how much success you've had, you still want to keep learning. What's the most important lesson that you've had to learn since you started training a few years ago?
That's a pretty good question. You know, I'd say just to kind of probably, you know, listen to the horse, you know, and adjust as they need it, you know, not to probably put expectations on them too much or, you know, trying to force them, you know.
You ever get a horse that surprises you? Maybe you think they're not going to be all that good and they can't run, and all of a sudden they figure it out and they can?
I've had a horse surprise me in a bad way. They, you know, I thought they could run. they did a turnout. No, I don't. So far, you know, I don't think I've had a surprise that they. I thought they weren't so good, and then turned out. But you know, as I say, it's kind of a small sample size so far. But you know, I feel like if they show me they're good, you know, I think they actually end up being somewhat good, you know.
You know, you mentioned in the first part of the program that it's right now you're training and it's your family that's involved with you. And, you know, your dad goes to the sales, helps you pick out horses and all those types of things, which is really, really cool. Do you see yourself, Matt, eventually, you know, building the stable, getting more horses for outside clients? Is that where you want to go?
You know, I kind of just take it day by day, race by race, you know. If it does happen, it happens, you know. I just try to do the best I can with and for the horses that I do have, you know, and whatever comes after.
Outside of your family, who are some of the people that have had the biggest influence on you and on your career?
Well, definitely, you know, my family's been a really big part. Alan Maraj, he helped guide me in those early days, starting up at Gulfstream Park West. You know, and a lot of trainers that have been, you know, between Jamaica and here. In Jamaica, there was a trainer named Maurice Powell. He trained horses for my grandfather back there. The same trainer that trained the Triple Crown when Al Safra, after she won the Triple Crown, he got some horses from my grandfather too. His name was Fitznahum Williams. And then being in here in Gulfstream, and you know, Collar and Gulfstream, a lot of Jamaican trainers have been very helpful. And you know, trainers, pretty much every trainer I've come across has been really helpful to me. I was in the barn with Barry Croft over at Collar. He was, you know, a good guy when we were over there to me too. Steve Budo, he was a trainer in Jamaica. He's here as well. He won a graded stake earlier this year with I Have a Jedi at Gulfstream on Florida Derby Day. He's been, you know, helpful to me. There's been a lot of trainers as well, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that there are so many folks and horsemen from Jamaica that have made their way here to the States and are now, you know, running their own business, training. We mentioned the top riders in the sport that have come from Jamaica. It's a horse racing culture. How do you describe what horse racing means to the country of Jamaica?
You know, it's a really big thing sometimes. You know, when I remember, you know, going there as a kid for like a derby or a classic race, you know, it was always, there was just a different feel to it, you know. And there was tremendous energy in the grandstands, you know. Everyone's so excited about it, you know, and extremely passionate about it there.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, when I was asking you, Matt, about your philosophy on training, I thought for sure you were going to tell me that one thing that's mandatory with all of your young horses is that they sit down and they watch videos of Usain Bolt.
Before
they start running.
For the sprinters, I probably wouldn't show Drew Murray since she runs, you know, a mile or more.
Have you ever had the chance to meet him?
No, I don't think so.
I think you would remember if you had that opportunity.
Yeah, I probably would, right?
Great stuff. Talking with Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Young man, just 25 years old, just getting started with that training career. He started training here in the States a few years ago and now has a pretty good filly by the name of Dream Marie, who most recently finished fourth in the Delaware Handicap, but she has been knocking on the door, second, third, in Great Estates Company, and you have to think that that big win is coming. Matt, for a young trainer like yourself to break through, to finally get a win, whether it's Dream Marie or another horse, that wins a Great Estates race, what does that do for a trainer's career, do you think?
You know, it's probably like a lightning rod for a trainer's career. You know, maybe they get more exposure and probably people who send horses, you know, and better quality horses that, you know, you kind of probably keep the ball rolling, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think that it has to be a big jolt. And at that point, I guess you'd have to open yourself up, and you said you're open to the opportunity, but you'd have to really start thinking about, you know, accepting horses for other people, because I think your phone would be ringing at that point.
Right, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Do you have a certain size stable that's like the ideal number for you?
No, I don't think so, you know. I hope to grow as well as we do, you know. That's just kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah, yeah. Are you one of the types of trainers that likes to be hands-on and touch the horses every morning, feel their legs?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I'm here pretty much every day. When we went with Jean Marie the last two times to Delaware, I groomed her myself as well, you know. So,
oh, wow.
Kinda,
so you kind of do it all. Yeah, you do it all.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. If you weren't training horses, what else do you think you might be doing if you weren't doing this for a living?
That's a good question. I don't know, maybe something economics-wise, you know. I got a degree in economics, so probably something to that effect.
Yeah, you mentioned you went to high school and to college in Florida. Where'd you go to college?
FIU, Florida International University.
And graduated with a career with a degree in economics?
Yes. Yep.
You know, you're way too smart to be a horse trainer. You know that, right?
I think there are probably even smarter people than me that are horse trainers, but I think horse training really could humble anybody.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the next question I have for you then. Why on earth would somebody like yourself, who has that degree and a good degree in economics, why would you choose to get up every morning at whatever, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, work 365 days a year? Why would somebody choose that life, Matt? Why'd you do it?
You know, I just always knew I wanted to be a trainer, you know, from I was as young as I can remember. So, you know, I don't think I'd go against the dreams of my younger self.
Yeah, great answer. You are still a young man, as I mentioned, just 25 years old. If somebody else comes to you, maybe somebody that's 18, 20, 22, another young person, and says, hey, Matt, I'm thinking about pursuing a career as a horse trainer. What advice do you give to them?
Go for it. You know, if it's what you really like and you're willing to do everything that it takes to be a horse trainer and, you know, be able to do it successfully too, you know, go for it, you know. Definitely.
Well, and you did just that. So you're telling them to do exactly what you decided to do.
Yeah, pretty much, yep.
Yeah. How come you ended up going back to Jamaica after you graduated college and didn't just stay here and start training?
Well, you know, just to be, I was involved in my dad's business down there as well. And we also had horses down there as well. And I just wanted to be, you know, there because we had those horses and being involved with those horses, you know.
Well,
and eventually
good.
I knew we'd probably start getting involved over here.
Yeah, it was a great, well, I'll call it an apprenticeship, even though that's not probably formally what it was, but it was a great learning experience, right?
Yes, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Matt, if there was one trainer that you could spend the day with and pick their brain and have dinner and ask them anything you wanted to ask them about training horses, if there was one trainer you could do that with, past or present, doesn't even have to be somebody who's actively training, who would it be?
You know, I probably could give you a lot of answers to that question. But, you know, I'd probably maybe say Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, you know. He's the only other trainer to train multiple Triple Crown winners. And he was, you know, a Hall of Fame type trainer back in those days, you know.
Yeah, that's an interesting answer. I was really expecting you to go with somebody that was more modern, currently training. But that's, you know, a fantastic answer. I think you could learn a lot from Sonny Jim. What do you think you would, if you were sitting down to dinner with him, what kind of questions do you think you'd have for him?
You know, well, I'd probably ask him about, you know, how he did it with the Triple Crown winners. And, you know, just his philosophy of training and, you know, everything that would go into that.
Yeah, well, we talked about your philosophy, and it would be great to hear Sonny Jim's philosophy, too. You know, people like that, you know, Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons and all the great trainers that were of yesteryear, if you will, we always hear that, and it's hard to compare athletes or teams of different generations, right? We hear that argument a lot in sports, but I think it's hard to compare trainers of different generations because the game itself, the economics were different. Everything was different in the approach back then as opposed to what it is now. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. You know, I guess, you know, evolutionary changing in the breed, you know, with our selective breeding and training methods and all of that. Yeah, things have definitely changed.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that they probably have. Do you think that the horse has changed, Matt, from years ago?
You know, I always hear people saying, you know, they're not as sound or whatnot as before. You know, for me, it's kind of hard to say, you know. I'd say it's really hard to say, you know, because sometimes you do see some really good horses around, you know, like American Fair and Justify and how well they ran, you know. So I think it's really difficult to say they changed in any bad or good way. But, you know, for sure they've changed, you know. Times change, everything changes.
Yeah, yeah. So we spent a lot of time talking about your big filly, Dream Marie, but you've had other horses that you have done pretty well with, too. Talk to me about some of the other horses that have come through your barn the past few years that you're always going to remember.
Well, probably Skyline View. That was my very first horse. That was the first horse I bought. And I think we ran him 26 times. He ran a couple seconds and thirds, but he never broke the maiden. And we retired him earlier this year. So I actually rode him the other day on our little farm there. So he's out there with a Shetland pony, and they're kind of inseparable now. I also did pretty well with our horse. Are You Talking to Me? We won, I think I won three races with him. I claimed him, had him for a while. They claimed him from this year. So he did pretty well for us too. He was a hard-knocking, hard-trying horse. I thought he could have been like, you know, maybe a claiming crown iron horse type of horse last year in the April, May, June, that time. But, you know, things didn't go that way for him. And we had to give him breaks and whatnot. I have another horse that I really like. His name is Emperor's Cause. He's still a maiden. I think he's run like eight times. The first time he ran, he lost by a late closing half length. So I really thought before he even ran as a 2-year-old training, I thought he was the best horse I've ever trained. You know, and he's still a maiden, but he's been running some good races. We just gelded him the other day. He ran first time back since being gelded. He lost by two noses. So I was pretty happy with that effort. Hopefully he wins soon. And he was half length behind Charlatan's brother earlier this year at Gulfstream. So, you know, I've always thought he's a good horse, but we just haven't really gotten it out of him yet.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. You know, you get a horse like that that, you know, you think can really run. It perks you up. It makes you want to get to the barn every morning. But it doesn't sound like you have a problem with that, Matt.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, I do miss my sleep sometimes, you know, but I definitely catch up.
You have to be a morning person if you're going to be a horse trainer, and that's certainly what my special guest Matt Williams is. He's gotten out there and done it and is making a name for himself here in the United States since coming here a few years back from Jamaica. You ever gotten a chance to talk to, you mentioned the horse, Are You Talking to Me? You ever get a chance to talk to Safi Joseph Jr. about his Triple Crown winner that he had in Barbados?
Yeah, he had the same name, right?
I've never
spoken to him about that horse. I've spoken to him a number of occasions, but no, I've never actually spoken to him about that horse.
Yeah, you know, that's, again, I've become very good friends with Safi and his family, and the minute you said, Are You Talking to Me? I said, wait a minute, that's the same name as Safi's Triple Crown winner.
Yeah, the same name. I think it's slightly different spelling.
It is. Yeah, I think he was A-R-E and the letter U, Talking to Me, how his Triple Crown winner was spelled. Yeah, you're 100% right. Talking with trainer Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Matt, we are inside the final furlong now, just inside of 5 minutes left here on the program. It's been wonderful to hear your story. I always like to end the show by asking trainers to tell me a little something about themselves that we have not talked about yet and people might not know. So what else should people know about Matt Williams? Are there other interests, other hobbies, other sports that you enjoy following? What else makes you tick, man?
Well, you know, I was a big soccer fan. I used to play soccer in high school as well, but in the past few years, I've been just so consumed with horse racing and, you know, all that's going on, you know. I also play cricket. I thought if I was ever to play a professional sport, it'd be cricket, just because my dad played and all my uncles played. You know, I thought I had some kind of ability there, but I never actually played to any real professional level or anything like that.
I have only watched cricket on television, and I grew up, I played baseball through college, and I'm thinking, man, that looks like, you know, you think a baseball is tough to hit. That looks like it could be tough to hit what do they call it? Is it a cricket ball? Am I even saying it correctly?
Yeah, it would be a cricket ball, yeah, and a cricket bat, yeah.
Yeah. Are there similarities? Do you see, like, good baseball players that can play cricket and vice versa?
Well, I can't really think of any, you know, actually. But, yeah, it's somewhat similar and somewhat different technique, right? You know, you're generally starting with the bat behind your back. Cricket, you're starting with it, you know, below your hip type thing, you know. Then it's a different shape, but the ball bounces before generally in cricket. So, yeah, it's slightly different, somewhat similar.
Hard to find a good pickup cricket game in South Florida, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think they do have, you know, some leagues and whatnot. But I've just never gotten involved too much.
Well, Matt, listen, it has really been fun to visit with you and to hear your story. And I want to wish you and your family all the best going forward. Dream Marie certainly looks like she could be any kind. And I hope you have lots of success with her and with all the horses that you have in your barn right now. Really appreciate you taking the visit and all the best moving forward.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Mike.
All right, trainer Matt Williams here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Yeah, fantastic story. And I love to talk with people like Matt who are so passionate about the sport. And, you know, yeah, he has interest in other sports somewhat, but he's become so consumed with horse racing, and rightfully so, that this is all he does, and this is his main focus, and that's why he's going to end up being successful. I know it. I just know it. My thanks to Matt for taking the time. If you missed any portion of this show, simply head to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show, all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure. Don't forget, too, to follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, another way that you can follow the show, and Horse Racing Radio Network on Instagram. Remember, too, when you're on our website at horseracingradio.net, not only can you hear all of our podcasts, but you can sign up for our two newsletters, our email newsletters we send out each week. The sign-up form is right there on our website, horseracingradio.net. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, for my special guest, Matt Williams, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.